2 weeks ago, I mentioned that our next sessions were going to be a lead into Easter and looking at things that we might not always look at when we're just focusing on the Easter story. So we know about the triumphal entry. We know about the arrest of Jesus. We know about the crucifixion. We talk a lot about the resurrection. But there's a lot of overlooked stories in this week that Jesus is spending his Passover in Jerusalem, this last Passover. The thing we talked about last week, or 2 weeks ago, last time I talked, was how Judas got the idea of the kingdom of heaven wrong, even after being with Jesus all that time, but how Jesus still extended to him great friendship, great honor, and great forgiveness. That's the heart of the Father, those three extensions of greatness there. Today we're going to talk about a parable that Jesus told during this time. And we're going to do what, like, you're not supposed to do when you're teaching. We're going to jump around and we're going to be sliding through from the New Testament to the Old Testament, back to the New Testament, and then back to the Old Testament, and then into Psalms. So if you don't have a printout, you're going to want one. So be sure you go grab one of those printouts. What we're going to be looking at today is I'm going to show you how Jesus has pulled a prophecy from Isaiah into his present time and how he applies the prophecy. Then I'm going to move into how this prophecy can be applied to us today. We're going to start with reading Matthew 21, verses 33 through 39. This is the parable that Jesus told about the evil vine dressers. There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a tower. And he leased it to vine dressers and went into a far country. Now when vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the vine dressers that they might receive its fruit. Okay, now Jesus' listeners are hearing this story, and so far this is a scenario that they understand. This actually would happen. It would take place. A landowner has a steward to oversee what's happening on his property. He does not have to be there. And if he's a wealthy landowner or if he has other places to go, then he would rent his vineyard and he would go do what he needed to do. And then the people left there would work the vineyard itself. And we've seen stewards already in a lot of Jesus' parables. So this idea is familiar with Jesus' listeners. And the landowner receiving his fruit, this is just like the rent. And this is something that we should all know about too. In fact, up to this day even. Like, I've got a friend in Montana she's in Alaska, but she owns land in Montana. And she rents her field to somebody who grows hay. And she gets some of the proceeds from it because she owns the field. It's just common. This is just what happens. Okay, so we should not be looking at this as a bad landowner who's trying to steal the fruit that the people worked hard for. This is not the situation. This is rent. They're paying rent. So the vine dressers then took his servants, beat one, killed one, and stoned another. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did likewise to them. Okay, now this is some inexplicable behavior here. Jesus' listeners are saying, why would they do that? There's obviously has been an agreement. They're obviously breaking an agreement. So why are they doing that? And then another question they're going to be asking, what is the landowner going to do about it? So both times, the vine dressers, when they beat the servants the first time, and then when they beat the servants the second time, both times the landowner here has extended grace. Instead of choosing anger, he has extended grace to them. So the picture Jesus is drawing for his listeners is of a gracious landowner, one who is slow to anger. The vineyard workers have acted shamefully. They've acted dishonestly, but both times the vineyard owner chooses grace. And then last of all, he sent his son to them saying, they will respect my son. Okay, so he has sent three contingents of people. Okay, we got the servants the first time, we got the servants the second time, and now we have the son going the third time. This is consistent with Hebrew storytelling. This is one of those things that you look at and go, okay, yeah, this is authentic. This is authentic to this time and this culture. And we see grace being rejected three times. Three different contingents, three different rejections. When the vine dressers saw the son, they said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." So they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. So here's an explanation of the behavior. The people are asking, why would they behave this way? Here's the explanation. They wanted to seize the inheritance. They wanted to keep the goods for themselves. Now, is this possible? Could that really have happened? Okay, if they kill the son, does that just automatically mean they get the land? Well, yes, in a certain sense, they would get the land. And here is how that would work. So if they are working the land, and if they could say a certain amount of time has passed and there's been no communication from the landlord, no, we haven't heard anything from him at all, he's not even collected his rent, it would be assumed then that the landowner no longer has any interest in the land, and so it would become theirs. All right, now, if you think this is odd, let me tell you about something in our own culture that works kind of this way. And this is a little bit opposite. It's not that if there's no contact, then there's presumed no interest. This works actually the opposite way, but it's still a pretty good illustration. So I was working with someone who was scammed out of some money. And the person who stole the money from them kept on promising, "Oh, dang, did we not? Oh, I will get that right back to you. Oh, haven't you got that check yet? I'll cut a check right now." And email would come and it would be like, USPS has registered, you know, but the check never came. They never came. And we would call back and they'd say, "Oh, well, here's a credit card number. Just go ahead and run the credit card and take the money from that." You know, so we run the credit card and no money, right? And so finally it's like, we are so tired of fussing with this. We just want to forget it, put it behind us and never have to think about it again. Okay. So a year passes and I got a phone call and it's that guy and he goes, "We just realized we never paid you back. We'll get a check in the mail right away for that." Check never came. Never nothing. Never payment. And I'm like, why did he call? Why did he even bother? We had forgotten about it and we've moved on and now I'm all riled up and upset about it again, right? Well, it turns out that as long as he keeps calling and acknowledging the debt and promising to pay, we can't do anything about it legally. We have to wait till a certain amount of time passes before we can say, okay, there's some bad faith here. He's not really going to pay back. Okay? So this is the same kind of thing, like I'm saying, only it's opposite. But we do still have that principle in our culture. So yes, if land is presumed abandoned, the people who are actually working it, the squatters, in fact, could claim it as theirs eventually. So this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, the landowner has no interest anymore in this vineyard, and so we're going to take over, and it's going to be ours. Now, we have a son here in the story, but Jesus' listeners did not just automatically put Jesus in place of that son as thinking of him as the Son of God, as we do. In this story, the son is just the heir to the land. If they can just get rid of the heir, then it can be theirs. So the son is killed. And then Jesus asks his listeners, upon returning, what will the landowner do? And Jesus' listeners say, by the way, Jesus' listeners here are the religious leaders of the day. Jesus' listeners say, he will bring those wretches to a wretched end. He will take away the vineyard from them and he will give it to other tenants. And then they're like, wait a minute. We just got tricked. They get angry because they realize that Jesus is talking about them. They're the wretches who are going to be brought to a wretched end. And they get angry and they try to arrest him at this point. Okay, so this is how they knew that Jesus was talking about them. They're pulling their experience from an Old Testament prophecy in Isaiah. So turn your page over and we're going to look at that prophecy as well. So this is Isaiah 5, 1 through 7. This is a part of Isaiah's prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Babylonian army back in 600 BCE. Okay? So let's go ahead and read that. I'll read it out loud to you. "My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill." So we have a parable here about a vineyard. "He dug it up. He cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the midst and also made a wine press in it." Well, Jesus' vineyard, that he's telling the story about has a tower and it has a wine press. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do with my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there, and I will command the clouds not to rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression, for righteousness, but behold, a cry for help. This is a situation in Israel just before the Babylonian army came in and destroyed. I said Israel, but actually Judea, because if you remember, there was two nations, the nation of Israel, the nation of Judea. And Israel had already been taken into captivity. So this is the nation of Judea here. All, though, what we call Israelites. So Isaiah's prophecy here he's prophesying the removal of God's divine protections around Jerusalem. The leaders, the religious leaders here, have been charged with injustice, oppression, and unrighteousness. So Jesus picks this parable up and he moves it into his present time. He adds a couple of details to it, and then he changes the ending. So the current conditions of the Jewish religion in Jesus' day was this. Jerusalem was the center of religious activity. It was also the center of the political activity. Herod's palace and the temple were adjacent to each other. Herod's palace actually overlooked the temple. The priests of the temple were in the Roman employ. They had promised the Roman rulers that they would keep the Jews in line. They would make sure that the religious fervor did not get out of hand. They would keep the Messiah idea under wraps. They didn't want people to be starting to think about a Messiah. And they did this in exchange for wages, perks, and political importance. So this is the priests of Jesus' time. They were Sadducees. They were wealthy. They didn't want anybody messing with their wealth. So the Pharisees, they also wanted to keep the Jews in line, but they had a different reason. They didn't care about pleasing the Romans. They were trying to please God. So in exchange for religious power, they promised God that they would make sure that the people obeyed his law. They set themselves up as the gatekeepers to the kingdom of heaven. They got to say who got in and who had to stay out. They were the fence builders to protect God's law. And then we have the elders that Jesus is talking to. The elders are the Sanhedrin, and they're the ones who make the decisions of the law. They're the ones who decide what punishments to be meted out to people who did not follow either God's law or the Roman law, although they were restricted in some of their use by the Romans themselves. So they were unhappy about that. So we have the temple system, the religious political system, being run by a corrupt family who were in pay of the people's oppressors. And they were aided by a faction whose goal was to keep people out of the kingdom of heaven. So this is the situation that Jesus is speaking this prophecy in a parable form into. Jesus has said to these religious leaders, "You are the evil vine dressers." And in saying that and evoking the Isaiah prophecy, he's telling them, your protections will be removed. The wall and the hedges that are protecting you are going to be torn down. But instead of destruction of the vineyard, Jesus has changed the end of the prophecy. And instead, he says, there will be new tenants. Now, it's important to see in Jesus' parable that the religious leadership is being taken away from a specific group of people. This is not God removing his covenant promises from the children of Israel. The nation of Israel still has the covenant. They still have the promises. What has happened here is at the destruction of the temple that Jesus is prophesying about, the need for the priests and the need for the Pharisees and the elders is gone. And so Judaism becomes what's called rabbinic Judaism, and it's the rabbis who now are the religious leaders, no longer these people that Jesus has just spoken about and to. And it's that way today. Today, Judaism is in the form of rabbinic Judaism. That's what we see. Because with the destruction of the temple, you didn't need priests anymore because there was nothing for them to do. Okay, now, Jesus says a lot of important things in the next chapter that we're going to skip over because if we followed all of them, we would end up down a rabbit hole that we probably wouldn't get out of until next Thursday. So we're going to follow the Jerusalem thread through what Jesus is talking about here, and we're going to pop up here at Matthew 23, and we're going to read verses 37 and 38. So that's on your second page. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often have I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Okay, so here Jesus, this is called the Jerusalem Lament, by the way. Here Jesus is talking to the people of Jerusalem, all of them, the leaders and the people of the land. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, he says it twice. And when Jesus says something twice, it indicates something. This is not Jesus standing there with his hands on his hips, shaking his head in disgust at them. This is Jesus saying, I empathize with you. I feel your pain. He says, Martha, Martha, one time. And he's telling Martha, I feel your pain. I know you're going through a hard time. He says to Peter, oh, Peter, Peter. And he's like, oh, things are going to get tough, Peter, but I'm going to help you hang in there. So he's empathizing with Jerusalem. I know what your pain is. This is deep empathy. It's not judgment on them. He understands their turmoil. And here's their turmoil. How long can they please both God and their political oppressors? Eventually, the answer is going to be, that's it. No more. The end. So Jerusalem, they kill the prophets. In fact, Jesus has sarcastically said once, are you even a prophet if you're not killed in Jerusalem? So a long list. Jesus goes through a long list of the prophets who have been killed in Jerusalem, ending with the prophet Zechariah, who was killed actually in the temple itself. And Jesus says to them, how I have longed to not punish you, not take revenge on you, not destroy you. How I have longed to draw you to myself. How I have longed to cover you as a hen covers her chick with her wings. This is protection. I've longed to extend these protections to you. But you would not have anything to do with it. You were not willing. So Jesus is using a picture of this hen with her chicks under her wing that we see in the Old Testament. So let's hop there to Psalm 91. Now I'm going to give you a couple of other places on your own if you want to look up this idea about God being a covering and a protection as a mother bird is a covering and a protection. Psalm 17, 8 and 9. Psalm 36, 7 and 8. Do you want me to go slow on this so you can write these down if you want to? Okay, I'll go back. Psalm 17, 8 through 9. Psalm 36, 7 through 8. Psalm 57, 1. Psalm 63, 7 through 8. And we're going to look at Psalm 91. Because I think that this is what Jesus was referencing when he showed this picture to them. Oops, I have it up here. So we have this picture of the mother bird protecting her young, and this particular psalm was written by Moses, most scholars think. David compiled it, and it's possible that he added the last three verses. So I'm going to read part of it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Psalm 91, verses 1 through 4. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him I will trust. Surely he shall deliver from the snare of the fowler, from the perilous pestilence. I like that, perilous pestilence. Say that fast three times. He shall cover with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. So there's the picture. There's the picture of the mother bird protecting. And then we have a long list of what they are protected from. Now, we sang that song this morning, A Shelter in the Time of Storm. And a lot of the images in that song are taken from Psalm 91. God is the shelter. And if you read through that, which go ahead and take that home and read through it on your own later on, you can see this list of all the protections. And then at the end, the last verse is Psalm 91, 14 through 16, we see why they are protected and we see how they are protected. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. So this is the idea that Jesus has referenced in his lament over Jerusalem. The list of protections that they are refusing. I long to gather you under my wing, but you would not. You would not have anything to do with me. And so, because they're refusing these protections, Jesus prophesies, "See, your house is left to you desolate, and I say to you, you shall see me no more until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" So Jesus again is going back to that same prophecy by Isaiah, and he's moving it again to the current day. So Isaiah has been told to preach to a people who are not going to hear, they're not going to listen, they're not going to see, and they're not going to understand what Isaiah is telling them. They won't change. And God tells Isaiah this before he even goes with the message. And Isaiah says, how is it going to end? We see it translated as how long. He's not asking how long he's going to have to preach. He's saying, how's it going to end, this scenario that you've just laid out? And he is answered. This is Isaiah 6. And I said, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities are laid waste without inhabitant. The houses are without a man. The land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. Okay, now it should be no surprise to you that this is a chiasm and that I have color-coded it, because what would we do without a color-coded handout? So do you see the parallels here? The green, the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant, and the forsaken places are many. So we have the idea, like the broad idea of the desolation. The houses are without a man, and the Lord has removed men far away. Same idea, the parallel idea here. And then the center, the land is utterly desolate. So the surrounding statements support that idea that the land is utterly desolate. So that's the prophecy. Isaiah's prophecy ends in desolation, as did Jesus' prophecy end in desolation. See, Jesus says, your land is left to you desolate. Isaiah's prophecy is about the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem by the Babylonian army. And that prophecy is fulfilled in 600 AD when the Babylonians take the Judeans off into captivity. Jesus' prophecy is about the destruction of the temple and the city of Jerusalem by the Romans. And we can look back and see that that prophecy was fulfilled in about 70 AD when the Romans were like just tired of fussing with the Jewish people and just came in and wiped out the city, wiped out the temple, and dispersed them to other lands. Neither of these two prophecies ends, though, at the destruction, even though it seems like it to us. Right now, studying prophecy is really popular because we see things happening around us that make us think that maybe we're getting into some of what Jesus has prophesied about and some of what we expect to happen. But to understand what's coming and looking forward to prophecy, we need to look back and see how these prophecies have played out in the past. So both Isaiah and Jesus' prophecies end the same way. Both of them have a return. There's always a return. Isaiah's prophecy says, as a terebinth tree or as an oak whose stump remains when it is cut down, so the holy seed shall be its stump. And Isaiah is saying there's going to be life left in the land, and from that stump, from that live stump, there will be growing a new nation. And we saw that happening when the Israelites went back from Babylon, back to Jerusalem, rebuilt the temple, and it grew back from this stump. There was a return to the land. And Jesus' prophecy ends also with a return. He says, "And I say to you, you shall see me no more until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" There's a return. There's going to be a time. Now, the beginning of this return we have seen. Three drunk Englishmen sat in a bar and drew out the new nation of Israel on a paper napkin, and there they were. Very inauspicious beginning. They had to fight for it. But since the mid-40s, Israel has come back to their land. There's the return. But we haven't seen everything take place yet from these prophecies. We have not seen yet the Davidic king return. So we've seen in the Babylonian prophecy that God gathered his people back. Well, first, even before that, he gathered them back from slavery in Egypt. Then he gathered them back from exile in Babylon. And now he has gathered them back from the dispersion by the Romans. But like I said, that Davidic king is not here yet. So that puts us squarely in the middle of this prophecy, looking back toward part of it being fulfilled and looking forward to the end of it being fulfilled. In Revelation, two more prophets have to get killed in Jerusalem. We haven't seen that yet. There's going to be another triumphal entry. The Judean leaders are going to get another chance to say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." This is what we still have to look forward to. And the reason for this is because the heart of God is always to return those who are in exile. His heart is to return those who are wandering. The heart of God is to gather his people under his wings, like we saw in Jesus' lament. He will restore the protections. He's going to rebuild the walls, and he's going to regrow the hedges. He's going to replant the vineyards. So the grapevines are going to grow, and he is going to harvest the fruit, and the fruit will be justice and righteousness. There will be no oppression, and when there's a cry for help, it will be answered. That's what this prophecy of Jesus is all about. Now, I'd like to end with a benediction, and I've started doing that, and I hope you guys like these because they're kind of cool, I think. So the one I'd like to end with this time is in Revelation. And in closing, Jesus says, "I, Jesus, am the root and the offspring of David and the bright morning star. The Spirit and the bride say, 'Come.' Let him who hears say, 'Come.' Whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. May the grace of the Lord Jesus be with God's people. Amen."